Hello, I'm Dr. John Davis. The podcast today is about forms of consciousness and particularly sleep, but also just your normal waking consciousness and some aspects of that, as well as things like hypnosis. So let's talk about some of the kinds of things that are going to come up today. For example, we're going to find out if you are in a sleep deficit. Are you behind on your sleep and experiencing some of those symptoms? Number two, we're going to talk about dreams. Does everybody dream? And what do dreams mean? Another thing that's going to come up today, do cell phones cause accidents? Do they deflect your attention enough to actually cause people to have accidents? And then the last item on the list is, what is hypnosis? What is it all about? Is it real? Well, let's first talk about normal waking consciousness, and I'm going to try to point out some of the terminology as we go along here that you need to know to understand these issues. For example, the first term that we need to know is selective attention. And selective attention means that you are designed, you have evolved, to be able to focus your attention on one thing. It's also called sometimes the cocktail party effect. And you can imagine what that might mean. It means that if you're standing in a party talking to someone who is 2 or 3 feet in front of you, and yet it's a pretty crowded room and there are people all around, you're going to hear their voices really at about the same volume. So you have the ability, though, to focus on the person who is in front of you and block out the other voices that are inputting to your brain at the same time. And that's called selective attention. It's an ability that has evolved as a necessary part of survival. We have to be able to focus on one thing because we're bombarded by as many as 50,000 bits of information at one time, and we have to be able to focus on one. Now, what this means is, though, the downside of this is that we really were not designed to multitask. You are designed to focus on one thing at a time. You can multitask, you can divide your attention, but when you do, your attention is going to be less for each thing that you've divided it for. For example, if you're in a car and you're talking on your cell phone, then your reaction times are slower for anything that might happen in front of you on the road. They're going to be slower in terms of your response to those incidents. So, can cell phones cause accidents? Absolutely. Absolutely. Being on a cell phone means that you're going to react to someone stepping in front of your car slower than you would have otherwise. There have been studies to show that this is absolutely true with control groups and experimental groups, in which the experimental group was talking on the cell phone, control group was not, and they were presented with the same incident at the same time in driving machines, and without a doubt and invariably, the people on cell phones respond slower. So what does that mean to you? Never talk on your cell phone in the car? I personally try not to. I try to get calls done before and after. And if I'm out on the road and it looks like I'm not needing full attention on the road, say on a freeway, I may briefly answer a phone call or make a phone call, but even then I'm trying to get off the phone as quickly as possible and not spend my time with the phone to my ear while I'm driving. I suggest you do the same. So that has to do with your normal waking attention. And another term where your normal waking attention is concerned is inattentional blindness. And what this means is if you are heavily focused on something, you are trying to accomplish something, that things may happen in your range of view that will not register in your brain. And studies have been done to show that this is true when people, for example, were asked to do something like count the number of shots, basketball shots, that were being made on a screen in front of them. Later, they failed to notice a woman walking across the screen with a parasol, an umbrella. And yet, when they were shown this later, they couldn't believe that they missed it, that they did not even see this. There have been several other kinds of studies that have been done to show this inattentional blindness or change blindness that occurs. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about sleep and dreams, that sort of thing. The first thing to know about that, and the first term to be aware of, is your circadian rhythm. Many of you may already know what that is. It's a hormonal rhythm, really, that your body is in the production of certain hormones like your adrenal hormones, cortisol, epinephrine, others, DHEA, are produced in a 24-hour rhythm. Another one is melatonin, which is produced by the pineal gland. The melatonin actually helps you get to sleep, and it is light, the appearance of light in your environment, that shuts down the pineal gland and stops it from producing melatonin. That's why people who work night shift have so much trouble keeping up with their sleep, because they're trying to sleep during a time when the room is lighter than it needs to be. And so the pineal gland shuts down, doesn't produce melatonin, and is very difficult to sleep. Melatonin puts us to sleep, essentially, helps us get to sleep. It's not that you can't sleep without it, it just makes it more difficult. Now, the good news about that is that you can use melatonin, which can be purchased over the counter in health food stores. If you use it on a short-term basis, or you wouldn't want to use it on a long-term basis, but on a short-term basis, you can use it to help you make adjustments in time zones. For example, if you're going to Europe or to, especially to the Far East, then you want to take a little bit of melatonin before you go to bed and help your body make that adjustment. The pineal gland is several days behind in making its adjustment to a shift in light like that. It gets on a time schedule, and changes in light will cause it to make a change, but it takes 2 or 3 days for it to make that change and catch up. So you can help it out a little bit by taking a little bit of melatonin. You can get it in 1 and 3 gram capsules, and either one of those is fine. I wouldn't take any more of that than that amount for the purpose of trying to get sleep, and I wouldn't do it for more than a few days in a row. You may train your body that it doesn't need to produce melatonin if you take it more than a few days in a row, and you don't want to do that. All right, now, if you're having trouble sleeping, we'll talk about some other things you can do a little bit later in addition to taking melatonin. Let's first talk a little bit more about sleep, though, and what happens during sleep. It's important to know that sleep occurs in stages, and there are two ways for you to have a sleep deficit. One is to, of course, not be getting enough hours of sleep at night, and the other is to not be getting the right kind of sleep, that is, not going through all the proper sleep stages and spending enough time in those stages. And it isn't just deep sleep that you need to spend enough time in. There's also a more shallow level of sleep, your REM sleep, what is called REM sleep, REM, It's the stage at which you are dreaming, and dreaming is quite necessary to us. Let me back up and explain what REM sleep is. It's called rapid eye movement, or it's an abbreviation for rapid eye movement, and it's called that because researchers have found that when people's eyes are moving rapidly underneath the eyelids, that they are dreaming at that time. And they know this from studies in sleep labs when people are awakened when the rapid eye movement starts. Even people who don't think they dream actually do. They just don't remember them. And when they are awakened in a sleep lab, these people who think they don't dream, when they are awakened, when they're having rapid eye movements, they will remember their dreams, and they do remember them. But otherwise, they may not. Well, if you don't have enough REM sleep, you are interrupted, and those studies also have been done. You're interrupted every time REM sleep starts. After a few days, you'll start to exhibit some symptoms of stress, extreme stress, maybe even to the point of schizophrenic type of symptoms, hallucinations and that sort of thing, or delusions. But if you are deprived of your dreaming, your REM sleep, you are going to experience something very quickly like, anxiety and tiredness and possibly worse. So that's one way to be short on sleep, is to not spend enough time either in REM sleep or the fourth stage of sleep, which is your very deepest stage or delta stage. The delta refers to the type of brain waves that are occurring. They're the deepest and slowest type of brain waves. So you have four levels, basically, of sleep that you move through in a 90-minute cycle. Stage one sleep, and the very first time you move into it, you may not be dreaming, but the next time you come back to stage one in about 90 minutes, you are going to be dreaming and really be experiencing, rather than stage one, what is called the REM stage. But REM occurs at stage one, is another way to say that. Then stage two, you move into after being for a while in stage one, moving through this 90-minute cycle. Something occurs with brain waves in stage two called spindles, and these are bursts of activity in your brain, and we don't know exactly what they are and what they're about. Stage three sleep is a little bit deeper and slower brain waves, and then finally the deepest sleep occurs at stage four, and the brain waves that are occurring there are called delta waves. So awake sleep are alpha waves in your brain, and deepest sleep are delta waves. Alpha, awake, deepest, delta. Good way to remember that. Okay, so remember that REM sleep occurs in stage one, or around, you know, it actually substitutes for stage one is the literal way of saying that. And that you have this 90-minute cycle that you must run through several times during the night, and if any of that is interrupted, you are going to experience some problems. However, worse problems if you're not allowed to dream. Okay, the average amount of sleep that's needed is apparently a little more than was previously thought. We really need about 9 hours, apparently. And if we don't get it, we build up what is called a sleep deficit. You build up this deficit that can't be made up by just having one good night of sleep. You can't, for example, miss 2 hours of sleep in the night for three nights in a row and then make it up by having one good night's sleep. You aren't back to normal in terms of the amount of rest and sleep that you need. So you have to make it up by getting more sleep over several days, and probably almost the amount that you missed to really get it back. And if not, if you don't, then you lose ability to concentrate. Your memory suffers. This is all supported by research. Your mood suffers. Hunger and obesity are affected by inadequate sleep as well. So, and your immune system, by the way, also. So you definitely need to get your sleep, and if you miss out on it, you need to catch up. College students, and I know that most of my audience is college students, about 80% of them are behind in their sleep due to late night studying and then on the weekend late night partying. So it's a good idea not to let that happen to you if you can help it and stay up with your sleep. You'll do better on your tests. You'll spend less time studying because your memory will be better. It's just really important for you to get your sleep. All right, well, let's look at some of the things that would indicate that you are sleep deprived. You'll see various tests or inventories that ask questions to determine whether you're sleep deprived, and they'll include things like this on there. Is it a struggle for you to get out of bed in the morning? Yes or no? Do you feel tired, irritable, and stressed out during the week? Yes or no? Do you have trouble concentrating and remembering? Yes or no? Do you often fall asleep in class or lectures or boring meetings or in warm rooms? Yes or no? Do you often fall asleep after a heavy meal or maybe a low dose of alcohol? Do you fall asleep while relaxing after dinner? Do you often fall asleep within 5 minutes of getting into bed? Do you often feel drowsy while driving? Things like, other questions like, do you need a nap to get through the day? Do you have dark circles under your eyes? All of those questions will be found on an inventory, which you can probably find a copy of someplace on the internet or in a basic psychology book. The book that I use in my classes, Myers' book, has an inventory like that on page 202. If you answer yes to a fairly large number of those questions, then you are sleep deprived. And if you are seriously sleep deprived, if you answer yes to most of those questions, then you are in trouble of various kinds. You are very likely to make mistakes. You are very likely to, much more likely to have an accident, much more likely to get sick, those kinds of things. So very important to sleep, and very important to dream. All right, well, let's move along and look at the sleep disorders. Sleep disorders, if I had to give you a quick list, I'd say insomnia is one, which is the inability to sleep. It may mean an inability to get to sleep, or it might mean waking up in the middle of the night and being unable to go back to sleep. A second one is narcolepsy, someone who falls asleep during the day at odd times. For example, I have a friend who will fall asleep watching television anytime, every time. He falls asleep standing up. He fell asleep at a wedding one time, and when he was in the wedding. So it's kind of an interesting problem that people sometimes have. He fell asleep at a red light one time and dreamed that it turned green. And you can imagine what happened. The horns blaring woke him up. And it was then that he finally decided to seek help. Sleep apnea is another sleeping problem. It really means that you have trouble breathing, that the tissues inside your respiratory tract close up on you as you lie down or sometime during the night, and you go through periods of being unable to get air, and it may or may not wake you up, but it probably does wake up the person you're sleeping with if you have a partner in bed there with you. Another one is night terrors. Night terrors is not nightmares. It's a whole different thing. It occurs at stage 4, for example, rather than nightmares, which are dreams and occur at stage 1. Night terrors are not dreams, and when people are awakened during a night terror, they'll report maybe an image that they saw, but not a dream, which is actually a sequence of events. And sometimes they won't report anything. Sleepwalking occurs at that stage 4. Talking in sleep occurs generally at that deepest stage of sleep, stage 4. Dreams, let's talk about those for a few minutes and what they are and what they mean. They are sort of could be called a hallucination of your sleeping mind, and they have what is called manifest content and latent content. Manifest content means what is actually going on in the dream, what's happening from moment to moment. It's the story of the dream. And of course, it often does not make good sense, and it shifts from one kind of scene to another. The latent content is actually the meaning of the dream, the interpretation of the dream. What's the symbolism behind the dream? And this is a pretty fuzzy area, and different theorists have different ideas about latent content and what it means. But I will say this much about it. These books that you see in the bookstore that say that if you dream about this object, it means this. If you dream about that object, it means something else. And they have a definite meaning for each thing that you might dream about. Those are total... let me say that a different way. They are not true. They are made up by the person who wrote the book, and there's no research to support that those things have those meanings. In fact, those things have different meanings for different people. A snake showing up in your dream doesn't necessarily mean the devil, or it doesn't necessarily mean evil. Maybe you like snakes, and a snake is one of your favorite things, and so it means something entirely different to you. And it also doesn't necessarily have anything to do with sex. Items in dreams or content of dreams themselves can be interpreted very differently by the person who's listening. My thought about it is that if you're going to interpret a dream for someone else, you have to know what's going on in their lives at the moment, what issues they're dealing with. You have to know a lot about their history. And then if you know all that, and the dream itself, then you may be able to make something like a reasonable interpretation. But even then, who can say that it's accurate? It may be useful, but is it accurate? Who knows? There's no way to prove anything like that. So it's very difficult to say that dreams mean a certain thing. Each theorist tends to say that dreams mean something different. They pick an item like dreams and try to bend it to fit their theory. Freud, for example, said that dreams were evidence of some repressed desire. Well, Freud was all about repressed desire, so that's what he said dreams meant. Adler, on the other hand, was about goals and life goals, so he said that dreams reflect your personal life goals. And so someone else who may be interested in some other aspect will have another interpretation of what dreams are all about. The real question is it useful for the therapist to interpret them, and do they appear to do a good job for you if you happen to be dealing with a therapist who does it? Okay. So that's about all I want to say about dreams. Let's talk a minute about hypnosis. And in most psychology books, hypnosis is a very short chapter, and there's a good reason for that. We don't know much about hypnosis. There are a couple of theories about it, but not much is really known. One theory is that it's not all that real, that basically what happens is that subjects who are being hypnotized are trying very hard to cooperate with the hypnotist, and so it's called a social theory of hypnosis, and they don't exactly lie, but they bend the truth to fit with what they know that the hypnotist wants to hear, or later on they take some suggestion and carry it out because they know that the hypnotist wanted them to do this. One thing that we do know is that you are aware during the time that you are hypnotized. You don't go into a state of unawareness. Now, the second thing we know, though, is that you are more suggestible during that time. You will take a suggestion to do something during that time that you might be more reluctant to do, or might find harder to do during your normal waking state. Hypnotism essentially is just a very, very relaxed state, though you are awake and aware. Now, it is possible that you may take the suggestion to forget something during the time you're hypnotized. You see this sort of thing done by stage hypnotists, and we don't have proof that they can actually make people forget things. I don't think the studies have been done to prove that, but the demonstrations they do are pretty convincing when they, for example, give someone a suggestion to act like a chicken when they hear the word chicken, and then to forget that suggestion, but to do it the next time they hear the word chicken. So the person goes back out into the audience after being awakened, and the hypnotist says the word chicken, and they jump up out of their seat and crow like a rooster. Well, to see the look on their faces when they do that makes you feel like it's real. But are they, because they're very surprised and embarrassed when they do this. But the question is, are they actors? And I cannot say for sure. We do not know. Now, the other theory, other than social cooperation concerning hypnosis, is that people actually have the ability to divide their consciousness, and it is this second consciousness that is performing or being hypnotized or under hypnosis. So that is a theory. We do not know. We cannot say. We do know that we are able to divide our consciousness, that is, kind of dissociate from normal waking consciousness. But is that what is going on in hypnosis? It is difficult to say. So again, not a whole lot is known about it, and you have to. Does it? Well, here's an interesting issue, though. Does it relieve pain? Does it provide good therapy for various things? That sort of thing. Is it therapeutic? And apparently, the one thing that it does do is relieves pain. We don't know about any other therapeutic suggestions. There is a little bit of evidence that it certainly reduces stress and therefore stress-related illnesses, but doesn't appear to help much with habits like smoking. So, there you go. All right. Well, that brings me to the end of a little presentation on consciousness. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I'll talk to you later. This is Dr. John Davis. Until next time.